to call the hearing, first hearing of the Special Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs to order. It is unfortunately about 7 minutes after nine. We're a little bit late getting started. It's February 7th. And let the record reflect the members that are present, Representative Kawasaki, Ledoux, Faircloth, Vuk, Ramirez, and Chair Roses. And this morning we have a presentation on brain injury, specifically returning service members that have been impacted. And I would like to thank Representative Lynn and his staff for ending the state affairs meeting early so we could use this room, and also Representative Faircloth and Ledoux for not scheduling their CRA meeting that they were going to have for this morning so that we could get this on the record. And then I also want to remind the committee members that we do have a 1 p.m. Meeting this afternoon in the Ramona Barnes Resource Room. So we are having our regular scheduled meeting this afternoon. So with that, I would like to thank our folks from that are assisting us over here. We have Debbie and
Steve.
And then, of course, my committee aide, Josh Appleby. So with that, let's go ahead and have the presenters introduce themselves and have at it.
Great. Good morning. Thank you for scheduling this special time to listen to traumatic brain injury and our returning service members and issues facing Alaska. Thank you to Representative Roses for organizing this and for Josh for really helping. It's been a pleasure working with Josh over the last couple weeks. The Alaska Brain Injury Network, has anybody heard of our organization? Well, basically, our mission is to educate, plan, and coordinate and advocate for a comprehensive service delivery system for traumatic brain injury survivors and their families. And we really feel that the military population is a group that will need lots of advocacy efforts towards. So that's why we're here today, and that's why we've been able to bring Dr. Barker. And Dr. Barker is a psychologist from Elmendorf. He'll be presenting mostly today. I'm just here to do the introductions on what is traumatic brain injury, how is it caused in the military, the treatment, and what Elmendorf right now is doing to build capacity for traumatic brain injury on the base. And then also Mrs. Stephanie Tanner. And Mrs. Stephanie Tanner is the wife of Sergeant Tanner. She will really speak to her life as a spouse to a traumatic brain injury survivor and share where she hopes her husband's outcomes and his life will be over the next couple of years because he has rehab at this moment. Let's see here. Was everybody able to read through some of the materials? I know you have some on your desk right there, but this presentation was mine that I was going to give the House Hess, and so Captain Barker has his PowerPoint that he'll pass out, or we'll get copies to you afterwards. But one of the messages we wanted to get across through this presentation is that right now the military is at the acute phase. I mean, these folks are coming back right now. They have come back in December, and they're just back from block leave as of January 25th, I believe, maybe 27th. And the military really is going to see how much traumatic brain injury is going to be an issue for the hospital base. And what the military will need to do after this acute phase is done is to really plan for the life of these soldiers. And in the civilian sector, states have been planning continuum of cares for traumatic brain injury survivors for 30 years. And so it's definitely a way that the state and the community and the military can work together to help build capacity for these TBI survivors and their families. And since we don't have anyone here representing the National Guard, I did want to speak a little bit to what they have been able to do to build some supports. They have a transition assistance advisor, and she has been organizing mass briefings for family members before the National Guard member returns home. And so the family sits through a presentation on what is traumatic brain injury, how does it present itself, and what can you do, how can you access supports. Also, they've hired some additional family counselors who actually go to the bush communities and meet with the family in the home and ask, is there any problems now that we could help with? And especially, they're there if they're called upon and they're there immediately. And they've also started grand round teams. So they have a representative from TRICARE, a medical person, a psychiatrist, and the VA representative, and the National Guard. And they go to the rural areas 90 days after the Guard has returned, and they ask, is there anything that's come about in these last 90 days that you need support for? So it's really been wonderful learning from the military. They only had a few months to organize and get themselves together to build capacity, and they've done it. And the fact that they recognized traumatic brain injury and they funded special positions to help get the supports out there is really great. And we hope that the civilian sector and the state of Alaska could also learn from that model, because TBI is recognized in the state of Alaska as the one of the highest disability for children. And also it's 30% higher than the national rate. And we as an organization have a few items in the governor's budget this year. It's $100,000 for brain injury training for providers. And what we're hoping is to increase that number through the legislative budget, because our community providers really are going to take a big brunt of the impact of the returning folks. And Providence especially, they're being accessed for rehab, and I'm sure some of our mental health centers and behavioral health centers will get some of this as well. And we're also really working to try to enhance the legislative budget with case management for the influx of people. Case management is core to the success of a traumatic brain injury survivor. And Dr. Cherry was here yesterday. He's a neuropsychologist at Providence, and he spoke to the Senate Hess and to the governor's office on really why is case management so important. And really, when you have a brain injury, when you don't have that capacity to plan for yourself and follow through, it's really hard to get to the services and the referrals that your doctors recommend. So case management right now would help for the outcome of these folks 30 years from now. And then also the fact that a lot of our service members and a lot of our civilians right now aren't able to work because of their traumatic brain injury. And when a person with a brain injury doesn't have a structured day and they don't have a structured place to go to, it's really easy for them to fall down. And it's really easy for them to do the things that we hope none of our family members ever do: substance abuse, suicidal thoughts, incorrections. And I can speak to that personally. I have a younger brother who had a brain injury 2 years ago. And us as a family, when he came out of his coma, we were ecstatic. We were so excited that he was going to live. And every day he showed progress. And he was in California. My family and my parents live in California. And he had access to brain injury rehab. We were like, man, we have it all. He's going to become who Clayton was before his injury. And the fact is, 2 years later, that he's not the same person, and that we're dealing with on a regular basis trying to keep Clayton in a structured environment where he will go to school and where he will not mess around with his friends. And teenage behavior, frontal lobe behavior, sometimes they're similar, but also the fact that we know Clayton's path is headed towards a path where he will come in contact with law enforcement. We're doing everything we can as a family every day to try to keep his life on the right path as well. And so here in Alaska, there's over the last 15 years, over 10,000 families have gone through the same situation that I have gone through. And 2,000 families have lost their family member. And this is something that can be planned for. Other states have traumatic brain injury service delivery systems. They have funding in the general fund. They have a traumatic brain injury waiver. They have clubhouses and rehab. And this is, there's a lot of science behind the system of traumatic brain injury and state policy. So we hope that we could work together and move this forward this year. And just knowing that over the next few years, the Brain Injury Network works very closely with the Mental Health Trust Authority and with the Department of Health and Social Services. And what they've really asked us to do is come up with a 5-year plan of how do you see the state implementing increased funding over the next 5 years, and what would be the priority projects. So we will have those budget recommendations by July. We do know that case management and clubhouse will be the two programs that are first prioritized on those. So with that, does anybody have any questions before I pass it on to Captain Barker?
Any committee members have questions so far? No? Seeing none, please proceed.
As Jill said, I'm Captain Barker, Dr. Barker, a psychologist at Elmendorf. Thank you for letting us be here to talk about these issues. I'm really here to talk about TBI. TBI is kind of, I think, a real well-known term, but what TBI is and kind of what we are doing here in Alaska with Fort Richardson and Elmendorf. And it's kind of unique because we are so co-jointly located, and having the 425 come back has really helped us work closer together in a lot of different issues. IEDs. I think everybody pretty much knows what an IED is. I hear about it all the time on the news. There you have two pictures of IEDs. You have one being on the top, which is the IEDs that are usually alongside the road, maybe put under road or looks like trash, and is very specific to what it targets. Rather than the lower picture with the vehicle-borne IED, which usually carries a lot more explosives and does quite a bit more damage and is going to affect a lot more people. Mild traumatic brain injury or post-concussive syndrome is really becoming the expression of the signature injury of the war. I will be really focusing more on the mild to maybe the beginnings of moderate traumatic brain injury, because really the severe and the more moderate and severe injuries won't make it up our way, at least in the acute phases, because we just don't have the services up here, and so they're going to be down in the lower 48. That's not to say once they begin to recover and get and recover to the extent that they can, that they won't be moved up here. I mean, if this is where they're wanting to live or whatever else, I mean, Alaska being one of the highest per capita of veterans that have retired and are living up here. So there is a strong possibility for veterans to be up here. Post-concussive syndrome, if you kind of just think about a concussion, it kind of implies a milder head trauma. A lot of times concussions will just the effects, the symptoms from a concussion will pretty much go away on its own within 3 to 6 months, maybe a year, even though sometimes it can go longer than a year. It could continue to resolve, or it could continue for a lifetime, even if it's only considered a mild traumatic brain injury. So don't think mild means, okay, you're good to go after a certain amount of time, because there could be longer lasting problems. And especially with this war being multiple IED exposures, multiple falls or motor vehicle accidents or whatever else, I mean, those compound and can make recovery a lot more difficult. But to kind of foot stomp, most people will recover. I mean, the resilience of the brain, and as we continue to educate unit commanders and the soldier themselves as well as family members, recovery rates will hopefully continue. What TBI is everybody aware of DVBIC or have heard of DVBIC? It's the Defense and Veterans Brain Injury Center. They've been really focusing on brain injuries since about the early 1990s. Their definition for TBI, I'm just going to read it, is it's an injury to brain resulting from a blast, a fall, direct impact, or motor vehicle accident which causes an alteration in mental status, resulting in headache, nausea, vomiting, dizziness, balance problems, fatigue, sleep disturbance, drowsiness, sensitivity to light and noise, blurred vision, memory problems, and or difficulty concentrating. So a multitude of issues. There's different types of head injuries, and I'm not going to go into all the mechanics, but the most common is the coup contra coup. So if you have an injury, individual that falls, hits their head on the ground, the brain kind of sloshes back and forth in the fluid in our skull. When we hit, the brain hits the back side of the skull and then the front side of the skull. So that's the coup and the counter coup injury. With a blast, though, because there's so many variables, there's a blast wave, there is fragmentation that comes up, and then there's the displacement of the body and wherever it goes, the brain gets really thrown around, twisted, bumps all over. And so that ends up to be more of a diffuse axonal injury. With that, we see axons actually sheared. We see them torn, stretched, twisted in ways that we are not aware, we haven't been aware of through the post-concussive stuff, from the sports concussive injuries. And that's kind of where all the research has been really up until this war. So with the newer medical technology, with the better protective equipment that our soldiers are carrying, a lot more people are living through this war that may have passed in previous wars. But because of that, we're seeing the after effects of head injury type of injuries that are going to be long lasting for our society as well as the individuals and their family. So some facts. Approximately 1.4 million traumatic brain injuries occur every year, and that's probably underreported. I just remember growing up in high school and getting dazed and confused from playing football or whatever else. Never went to the hospital, but that really is a concussion. And once you have a couple concussions, if you have three concussions, you're gonna go up threefold for another concussion. And each concussion can just successively get more and more brain injuries or make them worse. It makes the symptoms worse, last longer, and those things. So a lot of times they're not reported. So this is probably very a significant underestimate of how many happen every year. From OIF vets, 22% have reported having a TBI-inducing event. Out of those, about 7% are reporting continued symptoms. So whether that be right after the event or once they get back to the home states, still continued to report about 7%. In a major theater hospital, so something like Balad or Lion's Stool, 23% were screened to be positive for TBI, while 75% just complained of symptoms, may not have met all the criteria. So maybe there was some PTSD stuff going on or some chronic pain stuff or sleep issues, things that kind of overlap with TBI, but TBI was kind of ruled out. Overall, you can see that because even just with the 1.4 million, it is a major public concern for the amount of people in general. And as always, head injuries have always been around, but I think the military and what we are being exposed to is bringing it more to the public eye, I think, and people are becoming much more aware of head injuries now. The way that the military works TBI is we try to catch TBI as early as possible. That's not always able to be done, meaning if an individual is exposed or a unit's out and they're exposed to an IED blast, a lot of times they're going to come back, get back in behind the wire, and they might not go report to medical and say, I got knocked out, or I'm feeling a little dizzy, or I've got some headaches, or I'm having problems walking or whatever else. And a lot of times their buddies will also kind of help cover for them because they've had those same experiences. And they know we don't want to take anybody off the line. I don't want to leave my friends to go out to the next mission without me. I mean, a lot of guilt and remorse around that. So they don't want to report. But because of that, re-injury and re-injury and re-injury occurs. We're not allowing the individuals to maybe take a 7 to 14 day break from actually going out and doing the mission, where they might be hit more, which it just increases the chance that they're getting hit. And so that really affects recovery rate. So how we are trying to catch them is on the PDHA. It's a post-deployment health assessment. What that is really a standardized symptom questionnaire that the individual will fill in when they get either off the plane when they first get to their duty station or before they're getting ready to leave Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever they're at. And really that's a very subjective piece of paper. I mean, you just print out or you fill in a dot saying, yes, I've experienced coalition forces deaths, I've experienced enemy death, I've experienced blast exposures and those things. A lot of times, I can't say a lot of times, sometimes people aren't real honest on that because they worry, well, if I answer that when I get home, am I going to be able to go on my block leave, spend my time with my family, or am I going to have to stay back for evaluation and those things? So there's variables, and it is very independent on person to person on how they answer that. But we are trying to educate and say the earliest that we can intervene, the earliest that we can catch symptoms, the better we're going to be able to help the soldier as well as the family members. With mild TBI, neuroimaging is usually negative. So a lot of times, especially at the very beginning when TBI wasn't as well known or sought or looked for as it is now, people go to get neuroimaging because they're complaining of significant headaches, chronic headaches. Neuroimaging comes back and says everything's fine, and so they are just kind of given some medicine and said it will pass. And so they're just overlooking the possibility of TBI.
What procedure are they generally using for the neuroimaging?
They're doing CT scans and MRI type stuff.
They're not doing any of the PET with their radioactive metabolic processing?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not a neurologist. I haven't heard that. I mean, I just know right now they're doing the CT and the MRI. I know we've got some new stuff coming in at Elmendorf. I don't know if it's up and running or how that all works. I mean, that's kind of out of my scope. So I can find out for you and let you know if you want to know what we're exactly using for the...
I'd like to know what the new one is that's coming in, because one is certainly far more diagnostic than the other.
Yeah, this new one, they kind of showed pictures of it and how it spins and how much it takes. But, yes, I can let you know with that, sir.
Thank you.
But the foot stop with that is people, if they don't come in with, things coming out their head, fragmentations protruding out or faces all beat up or blood or whatever else, we kind of sometimes forget to say, well, there might be a head injury that we need to look at. And head injuries will complicate physical problems, psychological problems, and really even overall functionality. The individuals with eardrum ruptures, though, are three times as likely to have a TBI. And so that's one of the main things that we can look at. But to get an eardrum rupture, you're going to have to be pretty close to the explosion. So you're also probably going to have other physical injuries as well. What is happening now is the DOD is trying to implement what's called the automated neuropsychological assessment metric. What that is it's a quick cognitive screening prior to an individual deploying. What that's going to do is help when an individual comes back, if we suspect exposure to an IED or a blast or a fall or any type of head injury, we can readminister cognitive tests and then look at the baseline before they went to where they're at now and look where the deficits are, the problem areas are, and where we can begin to intervene. But from this graph, you can see right after the injury, those problems were found, those symptoms were complained of, and then even after returning home, it continues. So they are ongoing problems. It can be very debilitating. Okay, a study that was done about a year to a year and a half ago from one of the DivBIC sites. Really what I want to do with this slide is just show that there is a lot of comorbid psychological, psychiatric problems that go along with TBI. PTSD is the biggest one, and I don't know if anybody's aware of, there was a new article out by the New England Journal of Medicine that talks about looking at TBI, looking at what that does to physical, psychological, functional symptoms, and then when they take into account PTSD and or depression, the effects from the TBI dramatically decrease. So because there's so much overlapping, we really have to look at what the PTSD and the major depression stuff is doing with the overall TBI, and trying to get a handle on those to be able to also impact and work with and get some progress out of a TBI treatment. So treatment, I'll kind of quickly run through. Evidence for support remains pretty weak for treatment, for cognitive rehab type treatment. There is some education with, research support for education, and that education really should begin to happen prior to the individuals being deployed, upon their return, or during their medical recovery, as well as they ongo and continue to recover from their injuries, as well as education is needed to happen with family members, with the unit, the commanders, and those, so they can begin to identify individuals with problems. Palo Alto is down in California, and that's our servicing area from the DivBIC. So as you've seen, the headaches, the irritability, memory problems, and sleep problems are usually the biggest symptoms that we see. But because there can be so many confounding variables with the memory problems, we want to try to treat headaches, irritability, and sleep problems first, and then see where that takes the memory problems. The key elements to recovery is the education and reassurance. Talk about the education portion. The reassurance portion is we want to make sure our service members are told that they are going to get better, or we are setting them up to get better, because if they lose that initiative, that motivation, and think that all's gone, then they're not going to be motivated to make those changes, and they're going to not progress as much as they could. Rest and relaxation and some gradual return to activity. If we put people right back into the war, if we put people right back into a high stress, high mental area, cognitive problems usually come up and they start to really have problems functioning. And so they start to decomp a little bit. Big barriers to recovery are going multiple days with ongoing high stress with no treatment or no intervention. And that's what we see really out in theater, because people are constantly being put outside the wire and being exposed to more IEDs or just high stress of small arms fire or just day-to-day operations. And then, like I said, the comorbid conditions, PTSD, major depression, substance abuse, overall chronic pain issues are pretty big as well with that. I'm going to cruise through some of the treatment so I can talk about what we're doing. And just differentiate, there is a lot of overlap between TBI, PTSD. And so what this is just to really show where some of the differences are, with this one showing the TBI portion really comes pretty much right after the injury. You're going to start to have some symptoms, whether that be ringing in the ear or unconsciousness or headaches, while PTSD comes later down the road, where that's much more of an emotional reaction to the events and things that they've experienced. From Elmendorf's side, what we are doing is, since about June to July, we've started trying to be proactive in implementing a mild to moderate traumatic brain injury center or clinic within the third medical group. We're doing that. We're working real closely with Fort Rich, and we've brought in about 50 people to augment this time for what we see is going to be a high fluctuation of the 425 coming back and starting to have problems. We've brought in neuropsychologists because we don't have neuropsychologists, so we're really lacking, and that's really important to be able to identify the problem areas. We've brought in another neurologist because we only have one, and so that's a huge burden on him. And we brought in PT, physical therapists, occupational therapists, audiologists, technicians, just to help. The one place we are lacking is case managers. And as I believe Stephanie's going to talk, case manager is huge, because there are so many areas where the service member can fall through the cracks just because they forget, just because that's part of traumatic brain injury. They can't plan, they can't organize, they get overwhelmed very easy. And having somebody that can kind of hold their hand and help them get those skills and get the treatment they need is extremely adequate and something that is needed. And that's something that we are working to get. So far, We've had about 100 people come through just neurology, just for traumatic brain injury, just for the from the 425th. We've had, I think, two Air Force individuals, the rest being all Army. So, and that's not even close to what we are expecting. These are just individuals that have been seen through neurologists, not through their PCMs to try to work through headache-type stuff or sleep-type stuff or anything else. It's just been specific straight to the to our neurologists. And then we also have people in mental health. It gets kind of scary when you have people that are trying to figure out, okay, do I want to be diagnosed with a mild traumatic brain injury, and what does that really mean, and how does that going to affect me, or do I want to go to mental health, which has its own stigmas related to, especially in the military. And so they're kind of fighting themselves back and forth on what they're doing and seeing what the lesser, in their mind, what the lesser of two evils. And again, a lot of it is myths and stuff that we need to get out and more do the education piece. But we are trying to work closely with our Army counterparts to do that, since this really is a huge Army brigade that's come back.
Any questions? Representative Kozak?
Thanks, Captain Barker. Appreciate you coming today. You mentioned that this was a pilot-type program at Elmendorf and Fort Rich. I guess what's being done within the VA or the administration around the state? If you could just touch on that a little bit. And then specifically for people with longer-lasting traumatic brain injuries that deploy, come back to Alaska, and are Alaskans, what happens, especially the guard units that are out? And they may not live near a hospital. I know Fairbanks has a pretty good hospital now. Anchorage is pretty well sewn up, but the rest of the state, I'm just kind of curious how those folks would be addressed.
Right. I think Jill might be able to speak more. I mean, that's kind of what her mission has been here, is to look for to get some financial help to get something set in place, because there really isn't anything. I mean, at Elmendorf, even we are looking for partners in the community that we can send individuals to that we might be lacking, like neuropsych. I mean, there's five neuropsychologists in the Anchorage Bowl area. We had none, and so we were really highly utilizing them until we were able to get neuropsych individuals with us. So, and people out in the bush, and I mean, I understand all those complications and everything else. Around the nation, Virginia, I guess, is a good place to start. Are they one?
Through the chair, for the record, Jill Hodges, Representative Kawasaki. The VA really will have to answer that question. We can't really speak on behalf of the VA, but I could give you the name of the OIF, OEF case manager who could really speak to that, and then also the name of the transition assistance advisor for the National Guard.
Representative Ludo?
Do you work at all in the areas, the bush areas, with the Native Medical Services?
Do I? No, ma'am, I don't.
Or is there any, not necessarily you individually, but is there any partnership with those organizations to provide services for people in the rural areas?
I believe the VA has done some education. Colonel Powell, who used to be my flight commander, who's a psychiatrist who went up to the VA, has gone out and done some education on TBI, PTSD type of stuff. But I don't know how coordinated or how much support is given out there. That's above me. I'm not sure. I mean, I can find out. I can look more into it and see from military, or since we work so closely with the VA, see if they have an answer for that, if you want me to.
If you can get a quick answer on that.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Book.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Captain Barker, thank you for coming forth today. I appreciate all the testimony. And you mentioned earlier, you spoke very briefly about pre-deployment education. Could you give us a little bit more information on what it is that you try to do to these people who are in jeopardy of this condition?
Well, we try to do mass briefings or just-in-time briefings, depending on maybe where they're going to go or what they might experience. Air Force and Army might do things a little bit different. I know from the Air Force side, we will go out depending on what environment our airmen are going to be at and talk about what the exposures are and what could happen and educate on TBI or other type of issues like that. I know the Army has worked with spouses, and in fact, they've put out a what's called the chain training or chain teaching that was rolled out 1 August, I believe. That was more education for the spouses, so they would have an idea before the member gets back. Because really, from the Army side, because they've been hit so hard, it was more of a proactive or retroactive, just in time from before they get back. So what we're trying to do now is, for any other new units that go out, we want to do more training on, okay, these are symptoms of what you might be exposed to from a mental health side as well as from a traumatic brain injury side or exhaustion side or whatever else, and not only be aware of it in yourself, but be aware of it as your, you know, a battle buddy, your peer, your supervisor, your leadership, and that as well. So it's just as a way to watch out for ourselves, but also watch out for the individuals around us. Does that answer your question, sir?
It is. I was just wondering to what extent that's occurring so that, you know, out in the field, you and your companions out there have an idea of what it is that to anticipate and also as triage so that
right.
You understand what's going on.
Right.
Thank you.
If I could, I just kind of want a couple of questions that I have kind of summarizing to make sure that we're understanding where you're coming from. Is it the statements that you have made, both of you that have presented so far, that you feel that the facilities that both nationally and locally, while you're doing the best you can, would consider them at this time to probably be inadequate for what we currently need or what you anticipate our need is going to be?
No, I don't think they're inadequate. I think we've still got a ways to go where we're ideally wanting to be. I mean, right now it's very integrated, and so we're taking providers from around the state, you know, whether they be Air Force, Army, or even civilians we have coming up augmenting, as well as our own providers, which are kind of taking them a little bit away from their primary duties. But the overall goal is to make a traumatic brain injury clinic separate from the hospital, maybe still with under the roof, but separate from the hospital that has providers specifically to that, and be able to have that expand or contract as the need grows or goes away, you know, with brigades coming and going and things like that. So right now I think we're where we should be at, but it is kind of a short-term fix, I mean, because we don't have anything in place 100% in concrete, because these people will be leaving within about 6 months.
Okay, and you also stated that you felt that as the brigades come back that you're going to see a significant increase for the need for addressing care for TBI?
We are assuming that. That's what we're getting ourselves set up for, just in case. Yes, sir.
Okay. And then the last thing, obviously the brain injuries or anything that we can deal with the prevention of it, but certainly what would you expect from us as policymakers to do to try to help you address the concern that you have? And we certainly have limited capacity that we can get involved in, but what exactly do you see as our role in all of this?
Well, and again, I think that's where Jill would be able to better speak. I was just trying here to let you know what our role is, what we are seeing from the military, and maybe why the military has begun to make it more of a public awareness of TBI because of everything that we're being exposed to in combat. So.
Okay, and thank you for your testimony. Any other questions for Dr. Barker before we move on to some others? We also have a couple of people online. So, any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
And I don't want to rush you, but let you know that we have about 15 minutes so that you can kind of pace yourself.
Yeah, sounds great. For the record, my name is Stephanie Tanner. I am the wife of Sergeant Scott Tanner, OIF vet. We met in Alaska after his tour in Iraq. His tour was from 2004 to 2005, was his last tour in Iraq. While in Iraq, he sustained in excess of 30 IED explosions, and in excess, and didn't get too much of treatment while in theater, but they started to afterwards. But during the first year of our relationship, I saw him decline rapidly, with loss of fine motor skills, loss of mental capacity, loss of speech, just about everything. Depth perception. He was really going downhill. I did encourage him to go to the doctor as much as possible, but the doctors had no success in finding out what was wrong. They really didn't know at this time. But between January and May of 2000, multiple tests were done, EEGs, MRIs, neuropsych testings, to find out, you know, what was wrong with this guy. And he did get diagnosed with TBI in May of 2007. And since then, I've assisted him with appointments and medication management and all of the driving, because he can't do it. We do go to therapies at Providence. The therapies consist of speech, physical therapy for his vestibular dizziness and his depth perception, and occupational therapy, because the left side of his body doesn't work as well as the rest of him. So that helps out greatly, and as well as the warrior transition unit that the Army has instilled in place. Basically, it's a medical unit where all the hurt guys go in and they get case management. They get into a unit to where they don't have to do as much as physically as they would in a line unit, but they still kind of have responsibilities to fulfill themselves, but the utmost importance is to take care of themselves. But because there's so many hurt guys coming back, the case management is stretched so thin. If he gets 10 minutes, dedicated 10 minutes with his case manager, that's a great day. That's when I fall into being the pseudo case manager and, you know, help with the appointments and help with everything else. And our relationship is starting to turn between more like a parent-child more than, you know, a husband and wife partnership because of that. And if the military is having such a hard problem with case management, I know the civilian sector is as well. As well as with just the active duty pay, it really helps, but it's not sustaining what it could be. And if that's not sustaining on active duty when he retires out, because they can only hold you for so long when you've got such a extreme injury as he does, then they retire you out. They medically retire you out with half of your pay. And I don't know anywhere in the United States where you can sustain a family on $15,000 a year. But that makes it really tough. But if we did not have case management, I don't think he'd be as well off as he is right now, because for the first year and a half after he came back, he didn't receive any treatment or therapies, and because of that, his progress won't be as good as he could be for the rest of his life at 34. Yeah.
Representative Ramos.
Thank you. I want to thank you for your courage and for being so articulate and candid with us about sharing such a personal experience. You're a spectacular young lady. We all admire your husband and his service. And I represent Fort Wainwright in Fairbanks. Where did your husband serve?
He serves in Fort Richardson.
Fort Rich. And yeah. The captain and I were discussing before committee today that a lot harder on the men and women from Fort Rich than it was on the 172nd. And what you're doing here today is important, to put a face and feelings behind such an important issue. And I have, and I'm sure I speak for the committee, I have great admiration for your courage and for your ability to stick with your husband. It makes you a hero also, and I just want to thank you personally.
Thank you. Yeah. With that, I conclude. If there's any questions? No? Yes?
Representative Booth?
Yes, if you could, and I would like to mirror the comments of my esteemed colleague to my right. You're doing a spectacular job here today, and we really appreciate your efforts just coming forward. So Could you give us, in your review of the actual protocol, what really is it that happened, you know, from the time that he returned, as far as what's available, what happened, and give us some idea in your estimation of maybe where you would presume that a crack appeared and your husband fell in.
Well, the main crack was when he came back, TBI was not recognized at this time. So they like to call it the failed Fort Carson project. all the guys that came back from that brigade, which was about half of what went there, because they were just in a bad area, came back, and that's really what they started to try and work on. They did a bunch of tests and a bunch of check the blocks. Do you feel this way? Do you feel that way? And then he came to Alaska. He moved directly out to Alaska. The rest of the guys deployed back, sadly. But he came to Alaska, and Alaska really wasn't ready for anything he was about to put them through, so to speak. And he just went about living his daily life. For a year and a half, he went on. He trained two brigades to deploy. He trained an entire squad of MPs to deploy, all that while living with the TBI. And that, without that, him receiving the medical care then was the problem, because if TBI was recognized at that time, he would have more success in being a better prognosis on what he's going to do. But what is available now is the Warrior Transition Unit, which is a very successful, very great thing they have put in place, and they take care of making appointments and getting everything, being the middleman, so we don't have to, and navigating the systems and so forth. But the therapies available on post aren't as good as they could be. Elmendorf Hospital is beefing up their therapies really good, but Providence has actually got the best therapies I've seen so far, and that's really what's helping him progress.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony, and certainly for all of your support for your husband. And I noticed on your paper you had here that you said he went from being a professional hero to nothing. We would wholeheartedly disagree.
Those were his words.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to go online to Kenai Richard Warrington. Are you online?
Yes, I am.
Did you want to have testimony?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Special Committee. My name is Richard Warrington. I was enlisted in military services 31 years ago, and then 30 years ago, I received a severe traumatic brain injury while I was in Colorado, and I've lived in Alaska 22 years, and I was appointed ambassador on the ambassador program by the Brain Injury Association of America and a member of the ABIN here in the state. I'm asking you committee members to would really like you to work, help in making sure that the military and veterans don't fall through as many, if any at all, cracks of services needed for this type of injury, TBI. Like I have, I've noticed there's so much services don't understand, and TBI is a hidden disability injury, depending upon where the brain is injured, on what kind of disability a survivor would have, and depending upon the hardness of impact and the length of time in a coma, is what kind of injury comes up. Also, depending upon parts of the brain, different parts of the brain control different parts of the body. Do any of you have any questions for me? Because I'm still disabled after 30 years from my injury.
Any questions from anyone on the committee for Mr. Warrington? I don't see any. Thank you for your testimony, and certainly thank you for your service.
Thank you.
We also have online Terry Mata and Olivia Lawrence that are listening, and at least that's what they said. And as anything you've heard here moved you to want to testify as opposed to listening? If so, let us know. Okay. Didn't hear anything from either one of those. Anybody else in the audience wishing to testify? Seeing none, did you want to then conclude for us?
I did, yes. Thank you, Representative Roses. Your question was, what can you as policymakers do? And I think one thing that we at the Alaska Ranger Network are really trying to see is what are other states doing for this population. The state of Alaska is very unique because it's so small, and it's a system that's not in place for the civilian sector. It's a system that is rural Alaskans are having a hard time accessing VA benefits, and it's a system that with some sort of coordination, and the Brain Injury Network, with the assistance of Bill Hogan at the Health and Social Services and Jeff Jesse from the Trust, have worked to pull together a monthly meeting. And with the VA, the National Guard, the 3rd Medical Unit, the Warrior Wounded Warrior Project, and the VA Voc Rehab and Employment folks have been the ones who've been in the room so far. And just to watch the dialogue where the VA is asking Elmendorf, well, what are you doing? And then Elmendorf, or the VA is answering, and those groups just talking to each other are helpful because our state is so small. And this is a problem that we're going to have to really strategize around. The military is a new sector for myself and for our organization, so we're going to continue to do that. But I do know that, for example, Illinois, they have passed legislation so that any National Guard who feels as if they have a TBI but they have not screened positive anywhere can have voluntary screening through the state. And there are other examples of that happening around the lower 48. So, I mean, I look forward to continuing that effort and learning about those and sharing them with you this year and maybe by next week. And we could work maybe to get something going this year for education purposes and for momentum purposes, knowing that this is something that will be back next year and the year after and the year after.
Thank you. One of the things that I might suggest that you do is reach out to the Military Families Association and see if you could have a representative also attend that meeting from that group. I think that would certainly help in your educational perspective. One of the things that we had put together last year was one of our capital requests was for meetings that were going to be held in both Fairbanks, Anchorage, and in Kodiak to address some of the very things you're talking about, is what are the needs that we see arising for the veterans and for military families, and then have a full-day assessment of what that was with all the stakeholders participating. Unfortunately, their funds were cut out of the capital budget. We were not able to do that. We're certainly going to try to move forward with doing that again.
Was that and one of the cuts? That was one of the cuts?
That was one of the cuts, yes. And so
Kowalski was doing that, wasn't she?
That's correct. That's correct. And so we're hoping to get that restored, and this would go a long ways towards addressing those needs, not only in Fairbanks and Anchorage, but in Kodiak, some of the outlying areas as well. So we're hoping that those funds come through and that we're able to assist in that way in helping identify and as well as educate. So we certainly appreciate your efforts. And anything we can do to keep working in that direction, we certainly are here to try to provide that assistance. So that being said, is any other comments from the committee? Seeing none, we want to thank all of you for your testimony, and we certainly appreciate your being here. And with that, we are going to adjourn this special.